Next case we have for argument is Hyde v. City of Wilcox. Mr. Jellison, you may begin when you're ready and let us know if you want any time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jim Jellison. In this case, I represent a number of people from the Cochise County Sheriff's Office, Robinson, Progo, Bolander, Giganto, Noland, and Sheriff Daniels, from the City of Wilcox, Faulkner, Callahan English, Valley, and the Director of the Department, Mr. Hadfield. I do want to reserve at least 3 minutes, and my recitation of the names is quite intentional. If we were dealing with a denial of qualified immunity, excuse me, from one person or two persons who were defendants in cases, we would look at the conduct as it's alleged in the complaint for each of those two people and decide, does that conduct rise to the level of unconstitutional behavior? And even if it does it violate clearly established law that existed at that time that would have informed that person that what they're doing under those circumstances is unconstitutional? And the fact, excuse me, the fact that we have 10 individuals doesn't vitiate that requirement to any degree. And that was really the fundamental error at the district court level. We had 10 people involved here whose conduct is described in this complaint, and not once did the plaintiff or the district court make an effort to identify whether their individual conduct violated the Constitution or clearly established law. And they're entitled to that.
If I may ask a question here, it appears, at least based on the brief and the complaint, that there was some jailhouse video, but it doesn't appear that there's a video in the record. Can you explain why that video isn't in the record?
I think that when we briefed this case originally, the feeling was, and truthfully, the plaintiff had captured most of this event fairly accurately in the complaint. I don't recall that actually being offered, but it's certainly not part of the excerpt of records. And I don't think it's necessary. You know, this complaint really does describe an event in very clear terms and in two very distinct ways. You've got the first 5.5 hours of Mr. Hyde's incarceration where he is administered a blood draw, where he is in a cell again for 5.5 hours, and where he's engaged in relatively innocuous behavior described by the plaintiffs as napping, eating, talking to detention staff, requesting a phone to talk to a lawyer. There's not a single allegation that Mr. Hyde raised any mental health issue that needed to be addressed immediately, or any physical issue that needed to be addressed immediately. The only medication that's described in the complaint as being identified relative to Mr. Hyde on his arrest was Adderall. And there is certainly no constitutional principle that's going to require a jail annex to administer Adderall to a detainee at 2 a.m. before they're seen by medical staff.
We can fast forward at a certain point, according to the complaint. They put leg shackles on him, and he's handcuffed. And after that, according to the complaint, one of the officers tases him again, uses a taser on him again. Another officer puts him in some kind of head restraint. And, you know, at that point, if he's already shackled, you know, feet as well as hands, you know, why was the use of force necessary? And here, you know, and why I asked him, you know, about the jailhouse video is that actually would have been helpful for us to be able to see what is exactly happening. But based on the complaint, when someone, both their hands and feet are shackled, I mean, why was the unreasonable use of force to tase him again and put him in a head restraint?
Well, according to the allegations of the complaint, Your Honor, Mr. Hyde was involved in a chaotic fight with county and city staff for 15 minutes in this case. I mean, he is the instigator of that. According
but if his hands and feet are, I mean, what can you do if you're shackled both your hand and feet at that point? I understand it was chaotic and perhaps the use of force prior to that was reasonable. But once both the hands and feet are shackled and there are several officers surrounding him, I'm not sure what he can do. Again, that's why I asked for the video, because maybe that would have shed more light on what was happening. But just based on the allegations of the complaint, I'm not sure why any force would have been necessary at that point.
Yeah, and Your Honor, I'm not sure that I agree with the characterization that that's what the allegations say. At 7:51, Mr. Hyde's taken out of his cell in order to be evaluated for this self-inflicted head injury. And then immediately he's described by the plaintiff's complaint as sprinting in a fight or flight panic toward the female common area of this jail annex. And this is not the Department of Corrections here. It's not even a main county jail. It's a jail annex, so you can literally run from the male common area to the female common area. He's pursued. He meets a dead end, and he turns to face the three officers that are there at the time. And it's at that point that he's tased. There's no handcuffing. There's no shackling at that point. They're trying to control him. They get to the doorway. Again, using the terms of the complaint, there's still a scuffle. There still is a fray that Lieutenant Giganto and Sergeant Nolan join in on involving Hyde. They're still trying to control him. In fact, at that moment in time, he's described by the plaintiffs as fending himself against the officers. Why a detainee in a jail is fending themselves off against the officers at all is a problem for jail security that needs to be addressed through the use of physical force. He's not fully restrained until he's put in a restraint chair at 8:06. The last taser use was on his thigh at 8:05. There was no use of force used on Mr. Hyde after he was restrained at 8:06. At 8:15, the restraints were tightened by Sergeant Prago, and it's not until 8:24 that he starts to develop, 8:24 in the morning, that he starts to develop these more critical symptoms. He rolls his head back. According to the complaint, 3 minutes later, he takes his last breath. At 8:29, that's the first time that staff notices that there's a medical problem, and they act immediately. There's no allegation that Mr. Hyde was left alone, but there's also no allegation that any of the individual officers perceived that there was a medical emergency and were deliberately indifferent to that emergency. In other words, that they ignored it.
I'm not looking at the complaint. I think, you know, I agree with you perhaps on the use of force while there's a scuffle and resistance. But now I'm looking at the complaint. Paragraph 26 talks about how, quote, as leg irons were fastened onto him. And they use a taser on him. Perhaps he was resisting, so you need to use the taser to fasten the leg irons. Then paragraph 27, it says at 8:02 a.m., they quote unquote ultimately handcuff Luke Hyde's hands behind his back. So at this point, and then paragraph 28 says at 8:05 a.m., defendant Prago activated his taser on Luke Hyde's thigh one more time while defendant Callahan English forced Luke Hyde's head into a restraint hold. That's the troubling part here, at least for me, is paragraph 28, the allegations here is that his hands are handcuffed behind his back, there are leg restraints on his foot. Why was it necessary to use the taser again and put him in the restraint hold? And again, I sound like a broken record, but that's why I wish we had the video so we could see what is happening. And perhaps there is an explanation for this, but, you know, since there's no video, we have to, at the pleading stage, we have to accept what's alleged in the complaint.
And I believe, Your Honor, at paragraph 29, so even following 28, he's described as continuing to defend himself against the officers. So, And actually, I could be wrong about that, but that's
what it does. Paragraph 29 does say he's fending himself against, no. But I mean, you know, we have to construe things in favor of the non-moving party, and you know, I'm not sure if you're restrained foot and hand, what fending, you know, what that really poses any real danger to several officers rounding him, even if he's, you know, whatever fending off means in this context.
Mr. Jellison, if I can just ask, apart from the matter of the excessive force claim, in terms of inadequate medical care, does the record reflect that the officers waited until after the decedent was found without a pulse to check on him after the altercation?
The complaint does not talk in terms of, I think, pre-restraint evaluation. I think the record talks in terms of putting him into the restraint chair in order to control him at 8:06, tightening the straps on the restraint chair at 8:15 without any reference to there being any medical distress that would be noticed at that time, and that he rolls his head back at 8:24, and takes his last breath at 8:27. According to the complaint, the first issue of medical distress that is noted by any of the staff that are present on the scene is at 8:29, when they find him pulseless, get him out of the chair, and make efforts to resuscitate him. And I hope that answers the question.
Yes.
But I think that's how the complaint reads. And we need to take the complaint as it is. And I think that's why we have the plausible claim standard, is that if there was, you know, I think they cite the Jones case versus Las Vegas Metropolitan Police. And that's an extreme case where somebody's subdued, they're on the ground and they're in handcuffs, and then they're tasered for 90 seconds by multiple officers after that point. This is not that case. These allegations show Mr. Hyde fighting all the way through paragraph 29, and no force applied after he's completely restrained in the restraint chair and unable to sort of quote-unquote fend himself off against the officers. And the major point when it comes to qualified immunity is there's no clearly established law that would guide these officers and this detention staff that they couldn't use tasers or they couldn't use the peroneal strikes while somebody is fighting them, and while that person is still fending them off all the way through the point of time where they're placed in a restraint chair. Not a single case that would inform the officers of that fact. I think we all know that officers in a detention setting have to maintain security and control. They can't just let somebody run amok or attempt an escape. They have to use force. And quite frankly, this one person fighting off a group of seven or eight people, the amount of force that was actually applied in this case was relatively minor when it comes to tasing and below-the-waist strikes. There were no head strikes, batons, certainly no handguns, pepper sprays. I mean, they're trying to control a man who's creating a chaotic scene in a jail setting. Plaintiff has not shown a single case that would inform any of these officers that their conduct violated clearly established law. And that's why they were entitled to qualified immunity. If I may reserve my minute and 19 seconds.
Thank you. Ms. Sells? Yeah, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to cover the topics that we've just, that Mr. Jellison just now covered in terms of why the video wasn't attached to the complaint or the briefing. As Mr. Jellison noted, we felt that the complaint itself was very detailed in terms of providing a very accurate account minute by minute of what occurred that day, and so that we can comfortably rely on the allegations in the complaint. And in terms of excessive force, Luke had a clearly established constitutional right to be free from the continued use of force after he was subdued and restrained. So defendants are trying to reframe the issue by arguing that it doesn't offend the Constitution for an actively fleeing, actively resisting detainee to be subjected to tackles, tasing, strikes, and a restraining chair. And at the end there, Mr. Jellison was sort of implying that this force was relatively inert. Well, if it was so inert, then why is it that it caused Luke's death? But again, so this is not a situation where Luke was actively resisting the entire time. And I think you got it. You hit the nail on the head, Judge Lee, is that what we tried to explain here is that we've got five stages of restraint that were applied to Luke, and excessive force was used certainly at the latter stages unnecessarily, even after Luke was subdued. So you have the initial tasing that took place, and Robinson, Prago, and Bolander were involved in that. Robinson tases Luke twice, Prago tases him once. That then is followed by a gang tackle. We've got five officers that heap onto Luke, and that's Robinson, Prago, Bolander, Nolan, and Giganto. During that time, Robinson delivers 11 close-fisted perineal strikes to Luke's legs. Prago, at that same time, tases Luke yet again, not just once, but twice. And during that process, leg irons are fastened onto Luke. And the complaint says that at that point, these five officers attempt to drag Luke onto his feet, but Luke is so fatigued that he collapses to his knees. And at that point, then the officers, there's six of them at this time, Robinson, Bolander, Nolan, Giganto, Val, and Callahan English, who are wrenching and torquing his body, trying to get handcuffs onto his limp body. And then by the time the restraint chair is finally retrieved, it takes four officers, we note in the complaint, to hoist Luke's body into the restraint chair. And at that time, Prago tases Luke again, unnecessarily, once on his thigh, and then Callahan English unnecessarily puts Luke's head into a restraint hold while then after that the restraint chair's straps are tightened onto him. So what we have here is an escalating use of force that was used on Luke even after he was restrained and subdued, and that use of force reached a fatal level that caused Luke's death. And so this case is like Jones v. Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, because that case demonstrated that a suspect has a clearly established constitutional right to be free from the continued use of force after he's subdued and restrained. And specifically, the court said that the use of force can't be used on a prone suspect who exhibits no resistance, carries no weapon, is surrounded by sufficient officers to restrain him, and is not suspected of a violent crime. So Jones, in that case, like Luke, he attempted to flee. He didn't threaten the officer. He didn't commit a serious offense like Luke didn't. He wasn't armed. And the court there said that the initial use of the taser to stop Jones was reasonable. But, and this is critical here, when the situation evolved, the justification for the continued use of force waned, and at that time the officers continued to tase Jones even as he was being handcuffed, just as the officers here continued to tase Jones even after he was already in leg irons and handcuffed. And so the court in Jones said that the use of force was not necessary after Jones was prone and surrounded by four officers, and Jones, as we know, died as a result of the restraining procedures. Our case is even more favorable, so to speak, than Jones, because Luke wasn't just tased like Jones. Luke was dealt 11 close-fisted perineal strikes. He was tased, I believe, five, perhaps six times, and he was put in a restraint hold after he was subdued and restrained. And whereas Jones encountered just one to four officers at any one time, Luke encountered between three and seven officers. And unlike Jones, and probably most importantly here, Luke was a mentally disabled detainee who had been deprived of his prescription medication. So moving, yes.
That's the qualified immunity issues. I mean, I guess it would be an easy case if the record showed that Mr. Hyde had, you know, after being restrained with the handcuffs and foot shackles, completely submissive and did nothing. I think that would be a very easy case. Here, again, we don't have the video. The complaint's a little bit ambiguous. You know, the complaint does say he wasn't fully secured until 8:06 a.m. and that he was fending himself off. I mean, I don't know if Jones is directly on point, and it may depend on, you know, what exactly Mr. Hyde was doing at that time. I mean, can you shed any more light on what was happening at that point? I mean, I guess, you know, we're limited to complaint here, and maybe we construe it in your favor, but that to me is a sticking point here. Even now, I'm not sure what was happening after 8:05 until he was fully secured.
Well, in terms of the choice of words, I think that's semantics to say he was fending against 5 to 6 officers. The point there is that there were 5 to 6 officers using force of some degree against him at any one time. So perhaps the use of the word fending was not really the word that we... Maybe we could have picked a better word, but that doesn't mean to imply that he was actively aggressing or resisting at that time. But I think that the complaint makes it very clear that after the time that he has been shackled, that his legs have been shackled, and they attempt to drag him to his feet, but he's so fatigued that he collapses to his knees. At that point, he's clearly subdued. He's restrained by the shackles. He's surrounded by 5 to 6 officers at that time, and he's so limp that they're having difficulty trying to even put the handcuffs on him. At that point, he's subdued, and any additional force used against him subsequently is excessive force and a constitutional violation.
Your Monell claim was not just based upon inadequate training, it was also based on pattern and practice, was it not?
Inadequate training.
Exclusively inadequate training?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, all right.
And moving to the inadequate medical care, and there's two components there, one which relates to Loop's clearly established constitutional right to receive medical attention or monitoring after his extreme physical altercation with the officers. All of the officers that were involved in the altercation meaningfully participated in the inaction that gave rise to this constitutional violation. The defendants improperly, I think, attempt to argue the factual issue of the degree of the officer's knowledge, but in the complaint, we sufficiently allege knowledge. We allege that Luke and the officers engaged in extreme physical altercation, but despite that knowledge, Luke was left unattended for 22 minutes, and by the time he was finally checked on, he had stopped breathing and he had no pulse. And so this case is very similar to the case of Sandoval v. County of San Diego, where the court found that a nurse was not entitled to qualified immunity, where the nurse was told that Sandoval was sweating, tired, and disoriented, but the nurse didn't treat Sandoval. And rather, that nurse left Sandoval unattended. Now, similar to the officers here, that nurse sat 20 feet away, but the court still deemed that nurse to have abandoned Sandoval. And Sandoval later died of a meth overdose. And so in that case, this court also cites to Jett v. Penner, where this court held that prison officials violate the Constitution when they, quote, deny, delay, or intentionally interfere with needed medical treatment. And here, Luke needed medical treatment, and at a very minimum, that treatment or monitoring in this instance, at the very least, was delayed.
If I may interrupt, but Sandoval was a 2021 decision, right? So, I mean, you can't really consider that for a qualified immunity purposes because it wasn't a clearly established right when this incident occurred.
Well, Sandoval found that clearly established right by by citing to two cases, and perhaps more, but my notes reflect Jett v. Penner, which is a 2006 case, as well as Clement v. Gomez, which is an earlier case. I don't have right in front of me, but certainly predate the incidents here. And I've already talked about Jett v. Penner, but Clement v. Gomez is a similar situation where the court found that there was a constitutional violation for the failure to provide adequate medical care, where officers knew that inmates had been exposed to pepper spray, but waited for hours before allowing them to leave their cells to shower. So similarly here, the officers knew that Luke had been engaged in this very extreme physical altercation and that he was subdued with handcuffs, leg irons, and in a restraining chair, but nonetheless, they left him unattended for 22 minutes.
Pardon me, Ms. Sells. Could I ask you a question? What symptoms did Mr. Hyde present that required specific medical attention once he was restrained in that chair? Just gasping? That's the only thing I see that he was doing, is gasping. What kind of medical treatment do you think should have been prompted by that gasping?
Some level of medical monitoring at the very least. I'm not a medical professional, so I'm not really sure what sort of follow-up treatment would be given, but to monitor him.
I think if you're going to claim under Estelle versus Gamble that he's gotten inadequate medical treatment, you have to allege a fact which gives rise to a risk realized by one of the defendants. And the only thing I can see is that the man was restrained and gasping. What type of risk of injury does gasping after a fight take?
Right. I would, again, having no medical background, my assumption would be that the inability to breathe is a very serious medical condition, and it could have been a myriad of things. It could have been that his lungs were punctured. It could have been that the restraint hold on his neck somehow interfered or blocked his breathing. It could have been that the restraint hold was too tight and was preventing him from breathing. But we do know that somehow the culmination of the various injuries that he sustained through this altercation led him to stop breathing and led his heart to stop beating.
What type of, I have a difficulty that going from observation of gasping by a restrained individual after he's had a very exercised period of fighting to seeing what risk of injury was conveyed by the gasping. And what you're saying is you don't know because you're not a medical doctor, neither am I, but some sort of medical supervision should have been provided. What sort of medical supervision? A nurse? A doctor? I'm having difficulty.
It could have been someone who was medically trained. I believe that at least one of the officers there was someone who was medically trained. If it might have been Faulkner, if I'm not mistaken. But I think that any one of the officers would have been adequately capable of observing someone who is desperately gasping for air. And the result of this, the worst possible injury of an inability to breathe would be what happened here, which is death.
All right.
Thank you.
And I see I'm out of time. Thank you so much.
Mr. Jellison? I think you're still on mute.
I told myself I wouldn't do that. I'll speak fast on this. I agree, Judge Lee, that Sandoval can't apply as clearly established law because it's a 2021 case, but also because that's an instance where the staff was informed that the inmate had symptoms of methamphetamine overdose and was unobserved for 6 to 8 hours. We're dealing with a period of time where Prago tightens the straps at 8:15 and doesn't notice anything. The head rolls back at 8:24 and he's discovered in distress at 8:29 and action is taken immediately. There is no clearly established law that requires observation or prescience under those circumstances. And so there is no constitutional inadequate medical care. On excessive force, I still go back to 29 where it says at all times Luke was fending himself off. He was tasered at a time where he had leg irons on, but no handcuffs on. The only time that he was use of force occurred after leg irons, handcuffs, was as they were putting him into the restraint chair. That's the only time, and my concern is we're still lumping everyone together and we're not looking at the individually alleged conduct. I think when we do, we see no constitutional violation and no clearly established law violated. Thank you.
Thank you. The case has been submitted.